This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. 2001, I welcome Conrad Black to report on one piece of legislation that was paid in full in 2001, 60 years after. Conrad, a very good evening to you. As a member of the House of Lords, you are present at an event that marks the transition from the fears of the 20th century into the promise and now the considerable anxiety of the 21st century. 60 years after, what was the Lend-Lease Act and what did you witness? Good evening to you.
Yeah, good evening to you, John. Well, immediately after winning for the only time in American history a third term as president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, as was his custom, requisitioned a naval ship and went on a tour of the Caribbean, claiming to be looking at military installations and really having a nice holiday. And he contemplated how to assist the democracies in the war that was, they were then almost a year and a half into it by then. And but the United States, of course, was not at war. And he came up with this plan of lending the British and Canadians various military bases. I'm sorry, borrowing them from them. They would lend, the British and Canadians would lend bases to the United States in the Caribbean and in Newfoundland, and the Americans would lease them and then enable the British and Canadians and Australians to buy military related assets, air warplanes, warships, anything, right down to rope and mundane things like that, anything they wanted, and they could repay over a very extended schedule. So this took the immediate pressure off the treasuries of those countries. They didn't have to, as the neutrality legislation had required in the United States, to pay cash for everything. And one of the first orders was for 26,000 airplanes. Now, they couldn't fill the order at once, but they filled it over about 2 years. And once this was adopted, and these, all of these things were delivered to the United Kingdom in American ships, American flag ships, which the Germans could not torpedo without going to war with the United States. So it guaranteed the British would receive them. At that point, there was no chance whatsoever of Germany invading Britain, because no matter what Britain's aircraft losses, the Americans would replace them. And they supplied them with every imaginable thing, you see. And so at the same time, Roosevelt extended the territorial waters of the United States from 3 miles to 1,800 miles. It's more than halfway across the Atlantic. And he ordered the U.S. Navy to attack on detection any German ship. And it was a very idiosyncratic definition of neutrality. But the first significance was it was the absolute guarantee of the integrity of the British Isles. The Germans could not invade without sea superiority, which they had no chance of getting against the Royal Navy unless they had total air superiority, which they could then use to attack the Royal Navy and reduce it. They had no chance of any of that. The second consequence was that Hitler became convinced that the United States was conducting a huge arms buildup and was going to attack him eventually. So what he should do is attack Russia now, so that if he could defeat Russia quickly, he would be able to repulse the Anglo-Americans in Western Europe. And that caused him to attack Russia. And of course, he did not subdue Russia. Roosevelt extended Lend-Lease to Russia, and the Russians fought with, it must be said, enormous bravery. And Hitler found himself fighting the Soviet Union, the British Empire, and the United States all at once, and Germany could not possibly win that war.
So one piece of legislation leads to what we now understand, the saving of Europe from the Hitlerites and subsequent depredations that we've recovered from here in the 21st century. I learned this from a small parenthesis that Conrad posts in his National Post piece about that British Empire. I did not realize until your essay that the British Empire is a construction as of 1940 and the Lend-Lease Act, that at the Statute of Westminster on December 11th, 1931, what I assumed was the British Empire became the Commonwealth, and it was the independent members of the Commonwealth that themselves had to declare war on Germany. It wasn't just London speaks for everyone. Was that true with Lend-Lease as well? Did all the members of the Commonwealth go along with Franklin Roosevelt's idea of lending a hand without actually being in the war?
Yeah, the U.S. Congress, it took heavy intervention from the president and the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, and others really laying on the whips. And the Senate leader was at that time Alban W. Barkley of Kentucky, subsequently the vice president of the U.S. with Mr. Truman. And they all really laid on the whips, but they got it through. And then when it was through, it was offered to the Commonwealth countries, and since they had been asking for assistance, there was no suspense about whether they would accept. They accepted at once and with great rejoicing. And indeed, the British Parliament passed unanimously a measure thanking the President, the Congress, and the people of the United States in the most ringing terms. It's a wonderful a statement of Anglo-American solidarity. You see, at the end of World War One, the Commonwealth countries had made a very large contribution for their size, almost all of them volunteers, and none of them under threat. No one was threatening Australia or Canada, but we went to war anyway. So we earned the right to sign the peace treaty at Versailles. And from then on, we had a technical state of foreign policy autonomy, albeit in solidarity with Britain. And the measure you mentioned in 1931 effectively confirmed that those countries, at that time, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Newfoundland, and Ireland, were autonomous countries and sovereign countries. And so when World War II broke out, they were all neutrals until they themselves went to war. South Africa, I should have mentioned South Africa as well. Now Canada was about 2 weeks after the British, and then it was a belligerent in the war. Ireland never joined the war, as you know. And the others, South Africa, New Zealand, and Newfoundland, had reverted to being a colony and ceased to be independent. But Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa all individually declared war. We got around to it.
And that's the birth of the Commonwealth, 1931. That's it.
That's right. And it was called the British Commonwealth on the theory that the countries involved were all mainly Anglo-Saxon countries. But then when India joined the Commonwealth and became independent in 1947, the British was abandoned because it's obviously not a majority British country. So it became the Commonwealth of Nations. And of course, it still functions. There are 51 members in it.
And your measure today, is this a part of the Canadian understanding of its identity, that being part of the Commonwealth, being part of this peaceful transformation of an empire into a collective?
Yes. Frankly, I don't know that Canadians are as well informed about the details of it as you might hope they would be. But that is, in fact, those are facts of Canadian history, recognized by anybody who has any interest in or knowledge of Canadian history.
And because of this, what we're observing then in December 11th is a celebration of a success. I'm walking close to this because it's all news to me as well, Conrad. I was not given this in my 20th century education. This is a great success, the Commonwealth. Yes.
It's a little shaggy now, but it's had its successes. You know, it was very successful in opposing the apartheid regime in South Africa, and it does act quite effectively and benignly. It remains the vestige of Britain's former status as a great imperial power, and it is something that gives the British some influence in the world, unlike what for example, the continental European countries have. I mean, the French have their community of mainly those countries that were colonies of theirs in Africa, but they're not important countries like Canada and Australia and India. They're small countries, and they're not terribly well developed, most of them.
Is there a sense of interdependence today as there was during the conflicts of the 20th century? We have less than a minute.
I would say not exactly interdependence, but there's still a strong spirit of solidarity between, now this is a very unfashionable phrase, but what they were called before World War II was the White Dominions. And it wasn't a discrimination thing, it was just an identification method that of the mainly Anglo-Saxon countries affiliated in the Commonwealth do often act together, and especially now that Britain's withdrawn from the European Union, the cooperation between Britain, Canada, Australia, and several others, including Singapore, for example, is tightening again. And it's a good thing, because taken as a block, it is a group of strong countries that are relatively kindred spirits.
Conrad Black, writing for the National Post, a distinguished biographer, helping me understand where our friends to the north of America came from. December 1931. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.